lightsaber technique to compensate. He could probably adjust the servo drivers and pistons in his forearms to provide his hands with strength enough to crush the hilt of his new lightsaber. With the power of his arms alone, he had the ability to lift an adult being off the ground. But the Force had always given him the ability to do that, especially in moments of rage, as he had demonstrated on Tatooine and elsewhere. What's more, the sleeves of the bodysuit didn't hug the prostheses as they should, and the elbow-length gloves sagged and bunched at his wrists. Gazing at the gloves now, he thought, "This is not seeing." The pressurized mask was goggle-eyed, fish-mouthed, short-snouted, and needlessly angular over the cheekbones. Coupled with a flaring dome of helmet, the mask gave him the forbidding appearance of an ancient Sith war droid. The dark hemispheres that covered his eyes filtered out light that might have caused further injury to his damaged corneas and retinas, but in enhanced mode, the half-globes reddened the light and prevented him from being able to see the toes of his boots without inclining his head almost 90 degrees. Listening to the servo motors that drove his limbs, he thought, "This is not hearing." The med droids rebuilt the cartilage of his outer ears, but his eardrums, having melted in Mustafar's heat, had been beyond repair. Sound waves now had to be transmitted directly to implants in his inner ear, and sounds registered as if issuing from underwater. Worse, the implanted sensors lacked sufficient discrimination, so that too many ambient sounds were picked up, and their distance and direction were difficult to determine. Sometimes the sensors needled him with feedback, or attached echo or vibrato effects to even the faintest noise. Allowing his lungs to fill with air, he thought, "This is not breathing." Here, the medroids had truly failed him. From a control box he wore strapped to his chest, a thick cable entered his torso, linking to a breathing apparatus and heartbeat regulator. The ventilator was implanted in his hideously scarred chest, along with tubes that ran directly into his damaged lungs and others that entered his throat, so that should the chest plate or belt control panels develop a glitch, he could breathe unassisted for a limited time. But the monitoring panel beeped frequently and for no reason, and the constellation of lights served only as steady reminders of his vulnerability. The incessant rasp of his breathing interfered with his ability to rest, let alone sleep. And sleep, in the rare moments it came to him, was a nightmarish jumble of twisted, recurrent memories that unfolded to excruciating sounds. The medroids had at least inserted the redundant breathing tubes low enough so that, with the aid of an enunciator, his scorched vocal cords could still form sounds and words. But absent the enunciator, which imparted a synthetic bass tone, his own voice was little more than a whisper. He could take food through his mouth as well, but only when he was inside a hyperbaric chamber, since he had to remove the triangular respiratory vent that was the mask's prominent feature. So it was easier to receive nourishment through liquids, intravenous and otherwise, and to rely on catheters, collection pouches, and recyclers to deal with liquid and solid waste. But all those devices made it even more difficult for him to move with ease, much less with any grace. The pectoral armor that protected the artificial lung weighed him down, as did the electrode-studded collar that supported the outsized helmet, necessary to safeguard the cybernetic devices that replaced the uppermost of his vertebrae, the delicate systems of the mask, and the ragged scars in his hairless head, which owed as much to what he had endured on Mustafar as to attempts at emergency trepanation during the trip back to Coruscant aboard Sidious's shuttle. The synth skin that substituted for what was seared from his bones itched incessantly, and his body needed to be periodically cleansed and scrubbed of necrotic flesh. Already he had experienced moments of claustrophobia, moments of desperation to be rid of the suit, to emerge from the shell. He needed to build or have built a chamber in which he could feel human again, if possible. All in all, he thought, this is not living. This was solitary confinement, prison of the worst sort, continual torture. He was nothing more than wreckage, power without clear purpose. A melancholy sigh escaped the mouth grill. Collecting himself, he stepped through the hatch. Commander Appa was waiting in the ready room. The special ops officer who had led the 501st Legion against the Jedi Temple.
Your shuttle is prepared, Lord Vader,
Appa said. For reasons that went beyond the armor and helmets, the imaging systems and boots, Vader felt more at home among the troopers than he did around other flesh and bloods. Vader looked down at Appa and nodded.
Come with me, Commander. The Emperor has business for us on Murkana.
Shine squinted against the golden wash of Murkana's primary, which had just climbed from behind the thickly forested hills that walled Murkana City to the east. By his reckoning, he had spent close to 4 weeks confined with hundreds of other captives to a windowless warehouse somewhere in the city. Hours earlier, all of them had been marched through the dark to a red clay landing field that had been notched into one of the hills and was currently swarming with Republic troops. On its hard stand sat a military transport Shrine surmised would deliver everyone to a proper prison on or in orbit around some forlorn outer rim world. Thus far, though, none of the prisoners had been ordered to board the transport. Instead, a headcount was being conducted. More important, the clone troopers were obviously waiting for someone or something to arrive. When his eyes had adjusted fully to the light, Shrine scanned the prisoners to all sides of him, relieved to find Bal Shatak and her Padawan standing some 50 meters away, among a mixed group of indigenous Korovar fighters and an assortment of Separatist mercenaries. He called to them through the Force, figuring that Shatak would be first to respond, but it was Starstone who turned slightly in his direction and smiled faintly. Then Shatak looked his way, offering a quick nod. On their capture at the landing platform, the three of them had been separated. The fact that Shatak had managed to retain her headcloth perhaps explained why her short cranial horns hadn't singled her out as a brack and raised an alert among her captors. Assuming that the conditions of her captivity had been similar to his, Shatak's being overlooked made perfect sense to Shrine. Rounded up with hundreds of enemy fighters, following the still puzzling deactivation of Murkana's battle droids and other war machines, Shrine had been searched, roughed up, and marched into the dark building that would become his home for the next 4 weeks, a special torment reserved for mercenaries. Any who hadn't willingly surrendered their weapons had been executed, and dozens more had died in fierce fights that had broken out for the few scraps of food that had been provided. It hadn't taken long for Shrine to grasp that winning the hearts and minds of Separatist fighters was no longer tops on Chancellor Palpatine's list. It also hadn't taken long for him to give up worrying about being found out, since he'd been placed in the custody of low-ranking clone troopers, whose armor blazes identified them as members of companies other than Commander Salvo's. The troopers had rarely spoken to any of the prisoners, so there'd been no news of the war or of events that might have prompted the High Council to order the Jedi to go into hiding. Shrine knew only that the fighting on Murkana had stopped and that the Republic had triumphed. He was considering the advantage of edging himself closer to where Shatak and Starstone stood when a convoy of military speeders and big-wheeled juggernauts arrived on the scene. Commander Salvo and some of his chief officers stepped from one of the landspeeders. From the hatch of one of the juggernauts emerged Commando Squad Leader Climber and the rest of Ion Team. Shrine wondered about the timing of the commander's arrival. Perhaps Salvo was determined to have a close look at each and every prisoner before any were loaded into the transport. That Shrine was farther back from the leading edge of the crowd than Shatak and Starstone were meant nothing. Given the amount of time they'd spent with Salvo, he would have no trouble identifying all of them. Oddly, though, the commander wasn't paying much attention to the prisoners. His T-visor gaze was fixed instead on a Republic shuttle that was descending toward the landing field. Theta class, one of the prisoners said quietly to the mercenary standing alongside him.
You don't see many of those,
the second human said.
Must be one of Palpatine's regional governors.
The shuttle had commenced its landing sequence. With ion drive powering down and repulsor lift engaged, the craft folded its long wings upward to provide access to the main hold, then settled gently to the ground.
No sooner had the boarding ramp extended than a squad of elite troopers filed out, the red markings on their armor identifying them as Coruscant shock troopers. A much taller figure followed, attired head to foot in black.
What in the moons of Bogdan? New breed of trooper? Only if someone furnished the cloners with a donor a lot taller than the original.
Salvo and his officers hastened over to the figure in black.
Welcome, Lord Vader.
Vader?
The merc closest to Shrine said. Lord, Shrine thought.
That's no clone,
the first human said. Shrine didn't know what to make of Vader, although it was evident from the reaction of Salvo and his officers that they'd been told to expect someone of high rank. With his large helmet and flowing black cape, Vader looked like something borrowed from the Separatists, a grotesque, grievous-like marriage of humanoid and machine. Salvo was gesturing to Clymer and the other commandos, who'd remained at the Juggernaut. From inside the enormous vehicle floated a large anti-grav capsule with a transparent lid, which two of the commandos began to guide toward Vader's shuttle. As the capsule passed close to Shrine, he caught a glimpse of brown robes, and his stomach lurched into his throat. When the capsule finally reached Salvo, the commander opened an access panel in its base and removed three gleaming cylinders, which he proffered to Vader.
Lightsabers.
Vader nodded for the commander of his shock troopers to accept them. Then, in a deep, synthesized voice, said to Salvo,
What were you saving the bodies for, Commander? Posterity?
Salvo shook his head.
We weren't issued any instructions.
Vader's gloved hand waved him silent.
Dispose of them in any fashion you see fit.
Salvo was motioning Clymer to remove the anti-grav coffin when Vader stopped him.
Have you forgotten anyone, Commander?
Salvo regarded him.
Forgotten, Lord Vader?
Vader folded his arms across his massive chest.
6 Jedi were assigned to Mercana, not 3.
Shrine traded brief glances with Shatak, who was also close enough to Vader to hear the remark.
I'm sorry to report, Lord Vader, that the other 3 evaded capture.
Salvo said. Vader nodded.
I already know that, Commander. And I haven't come halfway across the galaxy to chase them down.
He drew himself erect with a haughty air.
I've come to deal with the ones who allowed them to escape.
Clymer immediately stepped forward.
That would be me. And us,
the rest of Ion team announced in unison. Vader stared down at the commandos.
You disobeyed a direct order from High Command.
The order made no sense at the time.
Clymer answered for everyone.
We thought it might be a Separatist trick.
What you thought has no bearing on this,
Vader said, pointing at Clymer.
You are expected to follow orders.
And we follow any reasonable ones. Killing our own didn't qualify.
Vader continued to point his forefinger at Clymer's chest.
They weren't your allies, squad leader. They were traitors, and you sided with them.
Clymer stood his ground.
Traitors how? Because a few of them tried to arrest Palpatine. I still don't see how that warrants a death penalty for the lot of them.
I'll be sure to notify the Emperor of your concerns.
You do that.
Shrine closed his mouth and swallowed hard. Jedi had tried to arrest Palpatine. The Republic now had an Emperor.
Unfortunately, you won't be alive to learn of his response.
In one swift motion, he drew aside his cloak and pulled the lightsaber from his belt. Igniting with a snap hiss, the hilt projected a crimson blade. If Shrine had been confused earlier, he was now overwhelmed. A Sith blade? The 4 commandos fell back, raising their weapons.
We'll accept execution for our actions,
Clymer said.
But not from some lapdog of the Emperor.
Quickly, Salvo and his officers stepped forward, but Vader only showed them the palm of his hand.
No, Commander. Leave this to me.
With that, he moved on the commandos. Spreading out, they fired, but not a single bolt made it past Vader's blade. Deflected bolts went straight through the helmet visors of 2 of the commandos,
and in two furious sweeps, Vader opened the pair from shoulder to hip, as if they were flimsy ration containers. Clymer and the third commando took advantage of the moment to break for the nearby tree line, firing as they fled. A deflection shot from Vader caught Clymer in the left leg, but the bolt didn't so much as slow him down. Vader tracked them, then motioned to his cadre of troopers.
I want them alive, Commander Apo.
Yes, Lord Vader.
Apo's shock troopers raced off in pursuit of the commandos. Not one of Salvo's officers had fired a weapon, but now all of them were regarding Vader with a vigilant uncertainty, their rifles half raised.
Don't let my weapon fool you,
Vader told them, as if reading their thoughts.
I am not a Jedi.
From off the shrine's left, a familiar voice shouted, But I am! Bolsh Attack had unwound her headcloth, revealing her vestigial horns, and had ignited the lightsaber Shrine thought she'd sense enough to ditch when they were captured. Vader whirled, watching Shattak as she began to stalk him, prisoners and troopers alike giving her wide berth.
So much the better that one of you survived,
he said, waving his lightsaber back and forth in front of him.
The commandos saved your life, and now you hope to save theirs. Is that it?
Shattak held her blue blade at shoulder height. My only intent is to take you out of the hunt. Vader angled his blade to point toward the ground.
You won't be the first Jedi I've killed.
Fearing that the prisoners would use the distraction to scatter, Salvo's men hurried in to form a cordon around them. Pressed in among everyone, Shrine lost sight of Shattak and Vader, but he could tell from the angry clashes of their blades that the duel was fast and furious. Momentarily immobilized, he allowed himself to be swept up in the surge of the crowd, so that he might be raised up over the heads of those in front of him. For a moment he was. Just long enough to glimpse Shattak, all grace and speed, working her way into her opponent's space. Her moves were broad and circular, and the lightsaber seemed an extension of her. Vader, by contrast, was clumsy, and his strikes were mostly vertical. He was, however, a full head taller than Shattak, and incredibly powerful. At various times, his stances and techniques mimicked those of Ataro and Sarisu, but Vader appeared to lack a style of his own, and executed his moves stiffly. With a whirling motion, Shattak got far enough inside Vader's long reach to inflict a forearm wound, but Vader scarcely reacted to the hit, and instead of seeing cauterized flesh, Shrine saw sparks and smoke fountain through Vader's slashed glove. Then he lost sight of them again. Wedged into the crowd, he wondered if he could use the Force to call one of the troopers' blaster rifles into his grip. He looked to the Force for guidance, and the Force restrained him. A pained cry cut through the chaos, and the crowd of prisoners parted just long enough for Shrine to see Shattak down on her knees in front of Vader, her sword arm amputated at the elbow. Vader had simply beaten her into submission, and now, with a flick of his bloodshine blade, he decapitated her. Sorrow lanced Shrine's heart. Unreadable behind his mask, Vader gazed down at Shattak's slack body. The clone troopers relaxed the cordon somewhat, allowing the prisoners to spread out. And the moment they did, Vader began to scan faces in the crowd. There were techniques for concealing one's Force abilities, and Shrine employed them. He also prepared for the possibility that he could be found out. But Vader's black gaze moved right past him. Instead, it appeared to focus on Olee Starstone. Vader took a step in her direction. Now I have no choice, Shrine thought. He was ready to lunge when a shock trooper called to Vader, reporting that the commandos had been captured. Vader stopped in his tracks, glancing in Starstone's direction before turning to Salvo.
Commander, see to it that the prisoners are loaded into the transport.
Again, Vader scanned the crowd.
A less accommodating dungeon awaits them on Aegon IX.
Vader had no sooner turned his back to the prisoners than Shrine was in motion, edging, elbowing, shouldering his way through the crowd to Starstone, whose narrow shoulders heaved as she attempted to suppress her grief at her master's death. Realizing Shrine was at her side, she turned into his comforting but brief embrace. "Your master is with the Force," he told her. "Rejoice for that." She narrowed her eyes at him. "Why didn't you help her?" "I thought we'd agreed to abandon our lightsabers." She nodded. "I abandoned mine. But you could have done something." "You're right. Maybe I should have challenged Lord Vader to a fistfight." Shrine's nostrils flared. "Your master reacted in anger and in vengeance. She would have been more used to us alive." Starstone reacted as if she had been slapped. "That's a heartless remark. Don't confuse emotion with truth." The prisoners were on the move now, troopers herding them toward the boarding ramp of the military transport. "Fall back," Shrine said into Starstone's ear. The two of them slowed down, allowing other captives to maneuver around them. "Who is Vader?" Starstone asked after a moment. Shrine shook his head in ignorance. "That's something we might be able to learn if we can remain alive." Starstone took her lower lip between her teeth. "I'm sorry about what I said, Master." "Don't worry about that. Tell me how Bolshattak was able to keep the lightsaber hidden from the guards."
"Force persuasion,"
Starstone said quietly. "Did you use force persuasion at any time?" She nodded.
"That's how I was able to hold on to my master's beacon transceiver."
Shrine eyed her in surprise. "You have it with you?"
"Master Shattak told me to keep it."
They were closing on the lip of the boarding ramp now, almost at the end of the line. Accepting of the inevitable, most of the prisoners were demonstrating remarkable discipline, and many of the troopers were drifting away as a result. Two troopers were stationed at the top of the ramp, one to either side of the rectangular hatch, and three more were moving more or less alongside the two Jedi.
"Vader is a Sith,"
Starstone said. Shrine showed her a long-suffering look.
"What do you know of the Sith?"
"Before Master Shattak chose me as your Padawan, I trained under Master Jocasta Nu in the Temple Archives. For my review, I elected to be tested in Sith history."
"Congratulations. Then I don't need to remind you that a Crimson Blade doesn't guarantee that the wielder is a Sith, any more than every person strong in the Force is a Jedi."
"Yes, but Jedi normally don't wield Crimson Blades," Starstone argued, "if only because of their association with the Sith. So even if Vader was nothing more than another apprentice of Count Dooku, why is he now serving Palpatine, Emperor Palpatine, as an executioner?"
"You're assuming too much," Shrine said. "Even if you're right, why is that so hard to believe when Dooku did just the opposite? Went from serving the Jedi Order to serving the Sith?"
Starstone shook her head.
"I suppose it shouldn't be hard to believe, Master, but it is."
He looked at her.
"Here is what matters. Vader suspects that two Jedi are going to be aboard the prison transport. Eventually, he'll identify us and we'll be killed, unless we take our chances here and now."
"How, Master?"
"Drop back with me to the end of the line. I'm going to try something, and I hope the Force is with me. If I fail, we board as instructed. Understood?"
"Understood."
The last of the captive mercenaries in Korovar moved past the two reluctant Jedi, up the ship's ramp, and through the hatch. At the top, Shrine made a passing motion with his hand to one of the troopers.
"There's no reason to detain us," he said. The trooper gazed at him from inside the helmet.
"There's no reason to detain them,"
he told his comrades. "We're free to return to our homes."
"They're free to return to their homes."
"Everything's fine. It's time for you to board the ship."
"Everything's fine. It's time for us to board the ship."
Shrine and Starstone waited until the final trooper had filed inside. Then they leapt from the ramp onto the clay field and concealed themselves behind one of the landing gear pods. When an opportunity presented itself, they hurried from beneath the ship and escaped into the thick vegetation, heading for what remained of Mirkana City. In his personal quarters above the Exactor, Vader examined the damage the Zabrak Jedi's lightsaber had done to his left forearm. After assuring himself that the pressure suit had self-sealed above the burn, he had peeled off the long glove and used a fine-point laser cutter to remove flaps of armor-weave fabric that had been fused to the alloy beneath. The Jedi's lightsaber had sliced through the shielding that bulked the glove and had melted some of the artificial ligaments that allowed the hand to pronate. Permanent repairs would have to wait until he returned to Coruscant. In the meantime, he would have to entrust his arm to the care of one of the Star Destroyer's medroids. His own lightsaber rested within reach, but the longer he gazed at it, and the blackened furrow in the alloy, the more disheartened he became. Had the hand been flesh and blood, it would be shaking now. Only Dooku, Asajj Ventress, and Obi-Wan had been good enough with a blade to injure him. So how had an undistinguished Jedi Knight been able to do so?
With the loss of my limbs, have I also lost strength in the Force?
Vader recognized the voice of the one who posed the question as the specter of Anakin. Anakin telling him that he was not as powerful as he thought he was. The little slave boy, cowering because he was not the master of his fate. A mere accessory in the world, owned by another, passed over, and now newly enslaved. He lifted his masked face to the cabin ceiling and growled in torment. Sidious's inept medroids had done this to him, slowed his reflexes, burdened him with armor and padding. He relished having destroyed them.
Or had Sidious deliberately engineered this prison?
Again, it was Anakin who asked, that small note of fear in Vader's heart.
Was this punishment for having failed at Mustafar? Or had Mustafar merely provided Sidious with an excuse to weaken him? Perhaps all along, the promise of apprenticeship had been nothing more than a ploy, when in fact Sidious merely needed someone to command his army of stormtroopers. Another Grievous, while Sidious reaped the real rewards of power, confident that his newest minion posed no threat to his rule. Vader dwelled on it, fearing he would drive himself mad, and at last reached an even more disheartening conclusion. Grievous was duped into serving the Sith. But Sidious had sent Anakin to Mustafar for one reason only, to kill the members of the Separatist Council. Padme and Obi-Wan were the ones who had sentenced him to his black suit prison. Sentenced by his wife and his alleged best friend, their love for him warped by what they'd perceived as betrayal. Obi-Wan, too brainwashed by the Jedi to recognize the power of the dark side. And Padme, too enslaved to the Republic to understand that Palpatine's machinations and Anakin's defection to the Sith had been essential to bringing peace to the galaxy. Essential in placing power in the hands of those resourceful enough to use it properly in order to save the galaxy's myriad species from themselves, to end the incompetence of the Senate, to dissolve the bloated, entitled Jedi Order, whose masters were blind to the decay they had fostered. And yet their chosen one had seen it. So why hadn't they followed his lead by embracing the dark side? Because they were too set in their ways, too inflexible to adapt. Vader mused. Anakin Skywalker had died on Coruscant, but the chosen one had died on Mustafar. Blistering rage, as seething as Mustafar's lava flows, welled up in him, liquefying self-pity. This was what he saw behind the mask's visual enhancers. Bubbling lava, red heat, scorched flesh. He had only wanted to save them. Padme from death, Obi-Wan from ignorance. And in the end, they had failed to recognize his power, to simply accede to him, to accept on faith that he knew what was best for them, for everyone. Instead, Padme was dead, and Obi-Wan was running for his life, as stripped of everything as Vader was, without friends, family, purpose. Clenching his right hand, he cursed the Force. What had it ever provided him but pain, torturing him with foresight, with visions he was unable to prevent? leading him to believe that he had great power when he was little more than its servant. But no longer, Vader promised himself. The power of the dark side would render the Force subservient, minion rather than ally. Extending his right arm, he took hold of the lightsaber and turned it about in his hand. Just 3 standard weeks old, assembled as Sidious had wished, in the shadow of the moonlit-sized terror weapon he was having constructed. It had now tasted first blood. The Sith grew past the use of lightsabers, Sidious had told him. But we continue to use them, if only to humiliate the Jedi. Vader yearned for the time when memories of Anakin would fade like light absorbed by a black hole. Until that happened, his life-sustaining suit would be an ill fit, even if it was well-suited to the darkness in his invulnerable heart. The comlink chimed.
What is it, Commander Apo?
Lord Vader, I've been informed of a discrepancy in the prisoner count. Allowing for the Jedi you killed on Mercana, 2 prisoners are unaccounted for.
The others who survived Order 66.
Shall I instruct Commander Salva to initiate a search?
Not this time, Commander. I will handle it myself.
Down there? Starstone said, halting at the head of a creepy stairway Shrine was already descending. The stairs led to the basement of a rambling building that had been left unscathed by the battle and was typical of those that crowned the verdant hills south of Mercana City. But she had a bad feeling about the stairway.
Don't worry. This is only Cash's way of keeping out the riffraff.
How is it you know this person? She asked over his shoulder.
Garulan's the reason the Council first sent me to Mercana. He's a former Black Sun Vigo. I came here to put him out of business, but he turned out to be one of our best sources of intelligence on Separatist activities in this quadrant. Years before Geonosis, Garulan was warning us about the extent of Dooku's military buildup, but no one on the Council, or in the Senate, seemed to take the threat seriously.
And in return for your intelligence, you allowed Garulan to remain in business.
He's not a hut. He deals in, wholesale commodities.
So not only are we on the run, we're turning to gangsters for help.
Maybe you have a better idea?
No, Master, I don't.
I didn't think so. And stop calling me Master. Someone will either make the Jedi connection or get the impression you're my servant.
Force forbid, Starstone muttered.
I'm Roan, plain and simple.
At the foot of the stairs was an unadorned door. Shrine rapped his knuckles on the jamb, and to the droid eyeball that poked through a circular portal, in response said something in what Starstone surmised was Korovar. A moment later, the door slid into its housing to reveal a muscular and extensively tattooed human male, cradling a DC-17 blaster rifle. Smiling at Shrine, he ushered them into a surprisingly opulent foyer.
Still sneaking up on people, huh, Shrine?
Old habits.
Shrine peered into the back room.
Is he here, Jally?
He's here, but not for long. Just packing up what we couldn't move before the invasion. I'll tell him.
Let's make it a surprise.
Jally laughed shortly.
Ooh, he'll be surprised, all right.
Shrine motioned for Starstone to follow him. On the far side of a beaded curtain entryway, a mixed group of humans, aliens, and labor droids were hauling packing crates into a spacious turbo lift. Even more well-appointed than the foyer, the room was cluttered with furniture, info storage and communications devices, weapons, and more. The humanoid standing in the midst of it and dispensing orders to his underlings was a Twi'lek, with fatty leku and a prominent paunch. Sensing someone behind him, he turned and stared open-mouthed at Shrine.
I heard you'd been killed.
Wishful thinking, Shrine said.
Cash Garulan moved his head from side to side.
Perhaps.
He extended his fat arms and shook both of Shrine's hands, then gestured to Shrine's filthy robe.
I love the new look.
I got tired of wearing brown.
His gaze shifted.
Who's your new friend, Roan?
Oli, Shrine said without elaboration. He aimed a glance at the packing crates.
Clearance sale cash? Let's just say that peace has been bad for business.
Then it is over, Shrine asked solemnly. Garyalin inclined his large head.
You hadn't heard? It was all over the HoloNet, Roan.
Oli and I have been out of touch. Garyalin snapped his fat fingers.
Just like that. One moment, Chancellor Palpatine has been kidnapped by General Grievous. The next, Dooku and Grievous are dead, the Jedi are traitors, the battle droid shut down, and we're one big happy galaxy again, more united than before. An empire, no less. No formal surrender by the Confederacy of Independent Systems, no bogged-down Senate, no trade embargoes, and whatever the Emperor wants, the Emperor gets.
Any comments from the members of the Separatist Council? Shrine asked.
Not a peep. I have to say, I never would have guessed the Jedi would be held accountable.
For attempting to arrest Palpatine, you mean? Shrine said.
No, for the war.
Garyalin stared at Shrine for a long moment.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, Roan, especially to you of old people, but the war has been laid at the feet of the Jedi. You manipulated the whole charade. Vat-grown troopers on one side, Master Dooku on the other, all in an attempt to overthrow the Republic and place yourselves in charge. That's why Palpatine ordered your execution, and why the Jedi Temple was sacked.
Shrine and Starstone traded looks of dread. Reading their expressions, the crime boss adopted a somber tone.
From what I understand, nearly all of the Jedi were killed, in the temple or on one world or another.
Shrine put his arm around Starstone's quaking shoulders.
Steady, kid, he said, as much to himself as to Oli.
The order was finished. Not only was there nothing for Shrine and Starstone on Coruscant, there was nothing for them anywhere.
For what it's worth, Garyalin said. I don't believe a word of it. Palpatine is behind this. He has been from the start.
Starstone was shaking her head back and forth in disbelief. It's not possible that every Jedi has been killed. She turned to Shrine.
Some Jedi weren't even with clone troopers, Master. Other commanders may have refused to obey High Command's execution orders.
You're right, Shrine said, trying to sound comforting.
We'll find other survivors.
Sure we will.
The Order will rebuild itself.
Absolutely. Garyalin waited for them to fall silent before saying,
A lot of others have had the carpet yanked out from under them. Even those of us at the bottom of the food chain.
He laughed regretfully.
War has always been better for us than peace. At least the corporate alliance was willing to tolerate us for a share of the profits. But the regional governors the Emperor installed are out to cast us as the new enemy. And between you and me, I'd sooner deal with the Hutts.
Shrine studied him.
Where's that leave you, Cash? Not on Mercana, that much is certain. My Korovar competitors in crime have my blessings and my sympathy.
Garyalin returned Shrine's look.
What about you, Roan? Any ideas?
Not right now, Shrine said.
Perhaps you should consider working for me. I could use people with your special talents, especially now. I owe you a favor in any case.
Starstone glared at him.
We haven't fallen so low as to... She started to say when Shrine clamped his hand over her mouth.
Maybe I will consider it.
But first, you've got to get us off Mercana.
Garyalin showed Shrine the palms of his hands. I don't owe you that much.
Make it happen, and I'll owe you. Starstone looked from Shrine to Garyalin and back again.
Is this the way you were before the war? Cutting deals with anyone you pleased?
Don't mind her, Shrine said.
What about it, Cash? Garyalin sat back in his oversized chair.
Shouldn't be too hard to equip you with false identities and outwit the local garrison troopers.
Normally, I'd agree, Shrine cut in. But someone new has been added to the mix.
a Lord Vader. When Garulan didn't react to the name, he continued, "A sort of black-armored version of Grievous, only more dangerous, and apparently in charge of doing Palpatine's dirty work."
"Really?"
Garulan said, clearly interested.
"I haven't heard anything about him."
"You will," Shrine said. "And he could present a problem to our getting off this rock." Garulan stroked his Leku.
"Well, then, I may have to rethink my offer, in the interest of avoiding Imperial complications. Or, we may simply need to take additional precautions."
Cash Garulan was trying to figure out how he could unload 800 pairs of knockoff NeuroSav electrobinoculars in a hurry, when Jally burst into his office to draw his attention to the security monitors. In mounting annoyance, Garulan watched 20 clone troopers climb from a wheeled transport and take up positions around the aged sprawling structure that was his headquarters.
"Stormtroopers, no less," Garulan said.
Pushing himself upright, he swept a stack of data cards from his desk into an open attaché case.
"I'll take the back stairs and meet you at the docking bay."
Hurrying out of his office and through the stockroom, he pressed the release for the back door, only to find a towering figure filling the entryway. Dressed in black from outsized helmet to knee-high boots, the masked figure had his gloved fists planted on his hips in a way that spread his cloak wide.
"Going somewhere, Vigo."
"Vader," Garulan told himself. The Grievous-like monstrosity Shrine said had been added to the mix.
"May I inquire who wishes to know?"
"You're free to ask,"
Vader said, but left it at that. Stretching out his right hand, Vader yanked Garulan off his feet and carried him through the foyer and into the office, where he deposited him in a caster chair which rolled backward and struck the wall.
"Make yourself comfortable,"
Vader said. Garulan rubbed the back of his head.
"It's going to be like that, is it?"
"Yes, like that."
Vader stood over him.
"I'm searching for two Jedi who escaped the transport that was to have delivered them to Aegon IX.
"Enchanting spot. But what makes you think?"
"Before you say another word, be advised that I know that you and one of the Jedi go back a long way."
Garulan immediately revised his plans.
"You're talking about Roan Shrine and the girl."
"Then they did come here."
Garulan nodded.
"They asked for my help in leaving Mercana."
"What arrangements did you make?"
"Arrangements?"
Garulan gestured broadly to the room.
"I didn't come by all this by accident. I was surprised even to see Shrine alive.
I told them that I don't help traitors. In fact, I reported their visit to local authorities."
Vader turned to the stormtrooper commander, who nodded his head and moved into the packing room.
"You wouldn't lie to me, Vigo."
"Not until I get to know you better."
The commander returned.
"He did contact the local garrison commander, Lord Vader."
It was impossible to determine if Vader was at all satisfied. At last, Vader said,
"If you were Shrine, what would be your next move?"
"Well, now we're speculating, aren't we?"
Garulan said, relaxing somewhat.
"I mean, you appear to be asking my professional opinion on the matter."
"And if I am?"
"I only thought there might be something in it for me."
"What is it you want, Vigo?"
Garulan adopted a more serious tone.
"I need you to put in a good word for me with the regional governor."
Vader nodded.
"That can be arranged, provided that your professional opinion amounts to anything."
Garulan leaned forward.
"There's this Korovar by the name of Biotto. Dabbles in smuggling and other ventures. Owns a very fast ship called the Dead Ringer."
He paused while the commander disappeared once more, undoubtedly to communicate with space traffic control.
"If I were in a hurry to get off-world with the least amount of problems, Biotto's the one I turn to."
"Lord Vader,"
the commander said suddenly,
"SDC reports that the Dead Ringer recently launched from Mercana Landing. We have the projected flight path.
Wings folded above its fuselage and running lights powering down, Vader's shuttle entered the Exactor's main docking bay and alighted on the lustrous deck. Nearby, and surrounded by clone troopers, sat the Dead Ringer, a somewhat boxy cargo transport, heavily armed with turbolaser cannons and outfitted with a state-of-the-art hyperdrive. Also under guard, the transport's mostly Korvar crew of seven stood with their hands clasped atop their horned heads while troopers completed a search of the ship. Already offloaded cargo containers were stacked outside the Dead Ringer starboard docking ring, awaiting scans. Vader and Apple descended the shuttle's boarding ramp and strode over to where the crew had been gathered. A trooper indicated the captain, and Vader approached him.
What is your cargo, Captain?
The Korvar glowered up at him.
I demand to speak to the officer in charge.
You are speaking to him.
The captain blinked in surprise, but managed to hold on to his angry tone.
I don't know who you are, but be forewarned that if my ship suffered any damage as a result of being targeted by a tractor beam, I will lodge a formal complaint with the regional governor.
Duly noted, Captain,
Vader said.
And I'm certain that the regional governor will take a keen interest in you once he learns that you are transporting prescribed weapons.
He swung to the officer in charge of the troopers.
Escort them to the brig.
Lord Vader,
Apple said, while the crew was being whisked away.
Security reports that two humans have been found in a secret compartment beneath the ship's galley.
Vader turned in the direction of the transport.
Interesting. Let's see what security has uncovered.
By the time Vader and Apple had moved around to the transport's port side, a detail of troopers was emerging from the ship with two humans in custody. The man was tall and long-haired, and very protective of the young woman by his side. The pair were dressed alike in robes and headcloths, typical of the mercenary brigade that had fought for the Separatists on Mercana. Their eyes widened on seeing Vader.
They are unarmed, Lord Vader,
one of the troopers announced.
We stowed away without the captain's knowledge, the man said. We're only trying to get to Ord Mantell.
You're not stowaways,
Vader said.
The captain was well paid to take you aboard his ship, and you have been promised payment as well.
The girl began to quake in fear.
We didn't know we were doing anything illegal. We're not smugglers or criminals. I'm telling you the truth. We did it only for the credits.
Vader appraised her.
I will consider sparing your lives if you tell me who hired you to carry out this deception.
The man firmed his lips, then swallowed hard and spoke.
Some of Cash Garrelin's goons.
Vader nodded.
Just as I suspected.
Lord Vader, our sensors may have found something,
Apple said suddenly.
The craft is only a cloak shape that launched from the outskirts of Mercana City. But it is pursuing a course that will take it close to the Exactor's previous position, and it is attempting to evade our scans.
The Jedi are aboard that craft. Can we interdict from our present position, Commander?
No. The cloak shape is out of the range of our tractor beam.
Vader growled in displeasure.
We will need to remedy that. Is my starfighter prepared?
It's waiting in launching Bay 3.
Assign two pilots to serve as my wingmates. Tell them to rendezvous with me in the launching bay.
The cloak shape, a broad-winged craft with a transverse maneuvering fin, had been modified for spaceflight. The cockpit had been enlarged to accommodate pilot and co-pilot, and a rear-facing gunner's chair had been installed in the tail section. Shrine was forward, Starstone aft, and in the pilot seat was Broody Gain, a freelancer who made occasional runs for Cash Garrulan. A rangy, dark-haired human a few years older than Shrine, he spoke basic with a strong outer rim accent. Shrine had already decided that Gain was the most casual pilot he'd ever flown with. Any farther from the instrument panel and his chair would have been adjacent to Starstone's. His hold on the yoke was negligent. Yet he handled the craft masterfully and didn't miss a trick.
Well, they've got a good fix on us,
he told Shrine and Starstone through the helmet comlinks.
D definitely going to have to upgrade our countermeasures at some point.
Hanging far to starboard, Vader's massive warship was just visible through the cloak-shaped triangle of transparasteel viewport. The console issued an alert chime, and Gain leaned forward a bit to study one of the display screens.
Three bandits closing on our tail. Signatures ID'd them as two V-wings, and what might be a modified Jedi interceptor.
This Vader character?
Good bet. Guess the Empire isn't any more choosy about commandeering Jedi hardware than it is Sep gear.
Obviously, we're still serving Palpatine in our own way.
Are you two aware that three starfighters are chasing us?
Starstone broke in.
Thanks for the heads up, sweetheart, but we're on it,
Gain said.
Here's another heads up for you, flyboy. They're gaining on us. Can't you coax any more speed out of this junker? It's about as lethargic as you are.
Gain laughed shortly.
I suppose I could try jettisoning the tail gunner. That ought to lighten us up.
First, you might try letting some of the hot air out of yourself.
Starstone fired back.
Ouch, Gain said. Is she always like this shrine?
She was a librarian. You know how they can be.
A librarian with the Force. Very dangerous combination.
He chuckled to himself, then asked, What happens to the Force now? Without the Jedi Order, I mean.
I don't know, Shrine said. Maybe it goes into hibernation.
Gain rocked his head from side to side.
Well, here's a little something to show you that the Force isn't the only game in town.
Gazing in the direction indicated by Broody Gain's gloved right hand, Shrine saw a swift space skiff approaching the cloak shape on an intercept course.
Hope it's on our side.
Gain laughed again.
It's our ticket out of here.
All but wedged into the cockpit of his black interceptor, Vader was in full command of the situation. He had the starfighter's inertial compensator dialed down and felt revitalized by the experience of near weightlessness. The cloak-shape's lead evaporated as he made adjustments and poured on speed. The Jedi's choice of escape vehicles was a reflection of the desperation, since the cloak-shape lacked a hyperdrive of any sort. But Vader saw what they had in mind. They hoped to rendezvous with the Soro sub-skiff that even now was angling toward them. The plan would have worked, however, only if Vader had taken the Twi'lek crime boss at his word. And because he hadn't, the Jedi wouldn't have enough time to transfer to the larger ship. By then, both the cloak shape and the skiff would be in proton torpedo range.
Form up on me,
he told the clone pilots in the escort V-wings.
And fire on my command. There's no need to take them alive.
Lord Vader, we have identified the Soro sub.
One of the pilots returned.
The registry is Mirkana. The owner is Cash Garulin.
So,
Vader said, mostly to himself.
It all ends here.
But there's something else, Lord Vader. The cloak ship appears to be fitted with external booster ring adapters.
Glancing at the display screen in which the cloak shape was centered, Vader issued a command to the astromech droid to display the skiff on a secondary screen. Instantly, he understood.
All speed,
he ordered the clone pilots.
This is not a rendezvous. Fire proton torpedoes the moment our targets are in range.
It was going to be close, Vader realized. He enabled the interceptor's laser cannon. The cloak shape too was traveling flat out, and was faster than he would have thought possible. The pilot was skilled and artful. At this distance, it would be difficult to keep him in laser lock. The astromech set an update to the cockpit data screen, and at the same time, the voice of one of the escort pilots issued through the console comlink.
Lord Vader, the skiff is positioning a hyperdrive booster in the cloak shape's flight path.
The vision enhancers built into Vader's mask delivered a close-up of the red and white hypermatter ring. Quickly, he thumbed the triggers on the steering yoke, and a hail of crimson bolts streaked from the interceptor's long-barreled laser cannons. But it was unlikely that the bolts would ever reach their targets, because the targets would be long gone. Still calling all power from the ion drive, Vader watched the cloak shape slip neatly into the precisely positioned booster ring and make the jump to light speed. A split second later, Cash Garulin's skiff engaged its hyperdrive and disappeared. Allowing the interceptor to power down, Vader gazed in defeat at the distant starfield. He had much to do to make himself whole once more. One of the V-Wing pilots hailed him.
Escape vectors are being plotted, Lord Vader.
Delete the calculations, pilot. If the Jedi are so determined to disappear, then let them.
Part 3. Imperial Center.
You have my full assurance that I will not disband the Senate,
the Emperor told the small audience he'd summoned to his new chambers.
Furthermore, I don't want you to think of yourselves as mere accessories, ratifying legislation and facilitating the business of governing. I will seek your counsel in enacting laws that will serve the growth and integrity of our empire.
He fell silent for a moment, then delivered his bombshell.
The difference now is that when I have taken into account your contributions and those of my advisors, my judgment will be final. There will be no debates, no citations of constitutional precedent, no power of veto, no court proceedings or deferrals. My decrees will be issued simultaneously to our constituent worlds, and they will take effect immediately.
The Emperor leaned forward in the high-backed chair that was his temporary throne, but not so far forward that his disfigured face was placed in the light.
Understand this. You no longer represent your home worlds solely. Coruscant, Alderaan, Chandrilla, all these, and tens of thousands of worlds far removed from the core, are cells of the Empire. And what affects one, affects us all. No disturbances will be tolerated. Interplanetary squabbles or threats of secession will meet with harsh reprisals. I have not led us through 3 years of galactic warfare to allow a resurgence of the old ways. The Republic is extinct.
Bail Organa barely managed to keep from squirming in his chair, as some of the Emperor's other invited guests were doing. Senators Mon Mothma and Garmbel Iblis especially, in what almost amounted to overt defiance. But if the Emperor was taking notes, he was doing so without most of his guests being aware of it. The Emperor's new chambers, the throne room for all intents and purposes, occupied an upper floor of Coruscant's tallest building, and in design more closely resembled what had been Palpatine's holding office below the Senate Rotunda than his former quarters in the Senate office building.
Your Majesty, if I may, the human senator from Kaminor said in a suitably deferential tone, perhaps you could shed some light on the matter of why the Jedi betrayed us. As you are undoubtedly aware, the Holonet seems reluctant to provide details.
Well beyond the need to employ diplomacy or deception to achieve his ends, the Emperor made a derisive sound.
The Order deserved all that it received for deluding us into believing that they served me in serving you. The complexity of their nefarious plan continues to astound me. Why they didn't attempt to kill me 3 years ago is something I will never understand. As if I could have stood against them. If it were not for the recent actions of my guards and our troopers, I would be dead.
Palpatine's off-color eyes clouded with hatred.
In fact, the Jedi believed that they could oversee the galaxy better than we could, and they were willing to perpetuate a war simply to leave us defenseless and susceptible to their treason. Their vaunted temple was a fort, their base of operations. They came to me with tales of having killed General Grievous, a cyborg no less, and sought to arrest me because I refused to take them at their word that the fighting was suddenly over. The Separatists defeated. When I dispatched a legion of troopers to reason with them, they drew their lightsabers, and the battle was met. We have the Grand Army to thank for our victory. Our noble commanders recognized the truth of the Jedi's treachery, and they executed my commands with vigor. The very fact that they did so, without question, without hesitation, suggests to me that our troopers had some inkling all along that the Jedi were manipulating events. After all these weeks, we still lack confirmation that Viceroy Gunray and his powerful allies are dead. That their battle droids and war machines stand motionless on hundreds of worlds, we can take as a sign of their surrender. At the same time, however, we must focus